Could you first tell me, Mr. Les Turtle, where and when you were born?
Yes, I was born in Stratford in 1927.
What?
My parents moved to Romford when I was 6 months old, and I lived there until I was 30. And I married and moved to Billericay. And after several years, we moved down to Kelvedon. We've been there until now, which is, what, 27 years.
What date in 1927 was it?
Oh, 15th of January, 1927.
What were the names of your parents?
William Howard Turtle and Alice Maud Lillian. Wade was her maiden name.
And what was your father's occupation?
He was an engineer, a refrigeration engineer, in charge of a big cold stores in the docks, in actual fact, at Wapping. We used to go there as children. A great thrill.
Did you have brothers and sisters?
Yes, I have three brothers.
And what did they do as careers?
Well, initially, my older brother was on the stock exchange as well. He joined a firm called Dunkley, Bedwell and Marshall, who now they're still around but been taken over. He wasn't there very long. I think he was there until the war. Then he went into the army. And after he came out, he went into agriculture himself. He ended up with pest control, which became Fison's.
Mm-hmm.
He was on the chemical side, advising, and then on the insurance side of it in the end. He's now retired and living in Spain. My next brother down did a number of various jobs. He ended up as a messenger of the Bank of England, in actual fact. The brother below that, I have three brothers, one older and two younger, as you can appreciate. He worked in for Lloyd's firm for a while.
Mm-hmm.
I can't remember why he stopped there, but he stopped that and eventually went up to live in the Midlands. He works for Rolls-Royce now.
Mm. So at some point, all of you had city jobs of,
yes,
of some,
yes,
form.
Mm. Well, I think if you lived in Romford, and unless you had London was quite near to go to at that time, and you looked to London to go to work, really.
Where did your parents send you to school?
Oh, I went to a normal local school. Mm. Didn't do very well at school, I'm afraid. Part of that was probably attributed to the war, but. I was one of those people that expected to pass 11 plus, but didn't. Mm. Went on to senior school. And of course, at that stage, the war had started, and we had a lot of interruption with our schooling. Mm. Used to sit down air raid shelters and that sort of thing. In fact, at one time, the schools were closed for some months. We used to just go up once a week to collect work and bring it home. And so we went after that, the school settled down again, but we spent quite a lot of time in air raid shelters. Mm. But I left school in 1941. At age 14, and by chance, really, I suppose, went to the city. I went to the local employment exchange. I mean, there's nothing startling about my start in life. Yes, I had gone to them, but my headmaster, a chappy named Skinner, very nice man, he had a friend called Newman who was actually worked for a member firm. And I think partly because of the war and the fact that, you know, you went to work at 14, 15, then you went off to the armed forces at 18.
Mm.
There was a continuous throughput of people in order to replace them. And they were looking for a young man, and I went up for an interview. My mother accompanied me, and I made her stay downstairs and went up for the interview on my own. Had an interview, and they took me on. So I started work with a firm, a stockbroker, not a stock jobber, a stockbroker called Fenn and Crosthwaite, and now part of Henderson Crosthwaite.
Did you have any idea what the stock exchange was about?
No, none whatsoever. No.
And what kind of job was it that they'd employed you?
Well, initially, I think virtually most young men were started those days as a messenger and postboy, really. You've got to remember that in those days, you hadn't got centralised systems. You actually delivered individually your stock to each individual firm, went round and collected your cheques from those firms.
Mm.
So you literally walked all around the city and ran on occasions as well. And it was many years later before we had what they call central stock payment.
Mm.
So the main job during the day would be, as I say, initially. Well, if one goes back and looks at it, I mean, our offices, as I've described in those notes, they were very Dickensian. We had a large mahogany counter. When you went in the door, there were two gas fires in the office. The office itself was high desks with brass stands in the middle of the high desk, which were back to back, with pull down lights that came down. You had high stools, which you would either sit on or stand at your desk. I think two, the manager and the assistant manager had low desks, but the rest had high desks. I mean, I'm talking about a firm that was probably 40 strong in absolute total, including all the partners, everybody. So that was the sort of office one worked in. And I'll say initially, one would be a messenger. You'd be responsible for getting the books out in the morning for the men from the sales, putting them away at night, running, as I say, delivering your stock, taking names, collecting dividends, that sort of thing. Paying in, obviously, 3 o'clock, 3:30, 3 o'clock, I think it was. And after that, you'll be doing the post.
Mm.
And when you finish that, you go home, which will probably be about 6 o'clock.
Was there much business in the stock exchange during the war?
We were always reasonably busy, yes. Mm. I mean, my memory nor my interest at that time would allow me to say the business levels were X, because I just wouldn't know. As a firm, I think we were doing 40, 50 bargains a day. Mm. It was quite reasonable. I mean, it kept us busy enough, and obviously the firm made a profit on it.
And how long did you stay with the firm?
Well, I was with them until I went in the army. What actually happened, after a while, I then became a blue button, unauthorised clerk, with them. And one's duties at that stage, I should recap a little, I suppose, and say that up to that stage, I'd done all the jobs in the office. I mean, one got rapid promotion in those days because there weren't the people, and you therefore had to quickly learn the jobs and do them. I'd done all the jobs in the office. I became an unauthorised clerk. One's responsibilities there were checking, and after that, working in the actual stock exchange, collecting what they call the offer lists from the jobbers.
Roughly, and when was that?
1940, I would guess 1944. Settling jobbers' list differences in the room, and obviously going around getting prices. Price, you got a list of prices. You went around certain times, as well as getting prices when somebody wanted a particular price. Interesting enough, a couple of anecdotes going back to that time, if you're interested.
Yes.
You can appreciate that when one first started work, you had to buy a suit because we had clothing coupons in those days. And it was a case of one suit. I mean, I don't even remember whether clothing coupons encompassed one suit or whether one had to have some of one's parents' clothing coupons. Anyway, it was one suit. So I actually wore it out, and my mother said, leave it at home tomorrow, and I'll repair it, and you're going to have to go to work in your sports jacket. And I said, no, you can't do that, not in the stock exchange. She said, you will. So I went in my sports jacket and flannels, quite respectable, but not the thing for the city. And obviously they were much more tolerant then than what they would have been today, because although I was cheered around the place, that was all. But the then chairman of the stock exchange, Sir Erling Clark, Ferguson Clark, which is became part of Pinching Denny, in actual fact. He was the chairman of the stock exchange. He came up to me sort of about 3 o'clock and said, you really shouldn't have come into the stock exchange dressed like that. And I tried to explain to him, very sorry, but I had no option. Yeah, I don't think he understood. Probably true to say people like him have a number of suits, but the other sort of interesting thing, we had a partner. We had two dealing partners who actually dealt on the floor all day, did all the dealing. Mr. Dunstan and Mr. Clokey. Interesting Christian name, John Sharp Neil Gurkha Clokey. Quite fascinating. Gurkha, that's spelled as in the Gurkhas. And he used to call me his pocket battleship. I was very small. I mean, I'm small now, but I was about 5 foot then. I used to move around the floor quite quickly. And I was known as his pocket battleship. But anyway, I went in the army in 1945. I was still in the house at that stage when I left to go in the army. And I came back from the army after just over 3 years in the army, 1948. And before I went in, I was on £4.10 a week.
Mm.
And when I came back, I was on £4.10 a week. And I stayed with the firm. I went back down the house as a blue button again. Unfortunately, I contracted rheumatoid arthritis about a year after being back in the city, which meant I was off work some months. I must say, the firm were very fair. Eventually, I went back to work after about 9 months off of work, but I could no longer walk properly. I had an ankle iron, and I had a very bad limp at that stage. And I went back into the office, and I stayed in the office, and I did very many, many of the different jobs in the office.
Mm.
And I suppose I actually went to City of London College and took exams, stock exchange exams, around about that stage, and passed exams and got a sort of prize from the Stock Exchange Council. I can remember going up to me having it presented. Anyway, again, it's a very long time ago. And I was with Fennancross right until 1954. And in that year, I'd had three rises, and I actually asked for a rise because I think I was on £7.10 a week by then, and they weren't prepared to give me any more money. And one of the chappies in the office I was very friendly with, a much older man, who was very good on the stock exchange, he really knew his business. I can remember I was at Fennancross when, for the very first time, as far as I can recall, bank rates changed from 2% to whatever, 3%, 4%. Nobody seemed to understand what it meant at that time, and he did and explained it. But anyway, he had a number of clients himself. He was a very astute individual, although he was only the dividend man in the actual office. And he went for an interview at what was then Durlacher, Deacon Godson. And he decided not to go to them, because if he went to them, he could no longer deal for clients. Mm. And the income he got from that, it wasn't worth losing that relative to the salary he would have got from Durlacher. He suggested I went round for an interview, and I went round for an interview. And they offered me a job, and I decided to take it. Mm. And I went there in 1954. One thing I suppose one should say about the city before we leave that sort of episode of one's life, people talk about sort of drink and this sort of thing in the city today, but it's nothing like it was then. I mean, there's a lot more drunk in those days. And we had several people in our office. One could almost only really describe them as drunkards. They were out at 11 o'clock, they were out at 2 o'clock. And they'd go out from the office in the evening and go into the pub again.
Were they partners or staff?
Staff. Mm. Oh, on the whole, the partners weren't like that. But some of these two particularly in our firm were. And used to cause a lot of problems, in actual fact.
Mm.
The manager was very old, probably a relatively weak man, couldn't control it.
Mm. How widespread was that? Was that something in our
There was a lot of drunk in the city, I think, in those days than what there is today. Although there's quite a lot of social drinking now.
Mm.
It's more after hours now than...
Mm. Is there any particular reason for that?
Whether it was hangover from the Great War, I just don't know.
Just going back a little bit to your days as a Blue Button... Do you have any early memories of what it was like going into the Stock Exchange?
Well, it was the old building, of course. It was a lovely old building, very large compared with today's Stock Exchange. Big pillars, and people used to sit around the pillars. And the mining market was down the end, or the other end of the market from where the War Memorial was. I suppose the extreme difference is the number of jobbing firms.
Mm.
Very large number, hundreds, probably 500-600. Mm. And each jobbing firm specialised in one particular market. So you actually had markets then in those days within the exchange, though the exchange is now known as a market. In those days, it was a market overall, but you had markets within the exchange. So you had an insurance market, a shipping market, a railway market, a mining market, oil market. They were individual markets, and the firms that jobbed in those markets would sit in that part of the market. So you'd go round to that individual firm if you wanted to price an oil stock, you'd go into that part of the market.
Were the particular firms that Finn and Crosswaite often went to, say as a Blue Button, did you find yourself?
Oh, as a Blue Button, I think you went to the people who would look after you best in terms of giving you prices. I mean, there was a firm called Frisby and Co.
Mm.
The senior partner of Frisby, he was a VC actually from the Great War. He was an absolutely marvellous man. Mm. Always had time to talk to you, you know.
Mm.
But I mean, another little anecdote. I can remember I had a new suit on one day, and there was. I can't remember the name of the gentleman now. But anyway, I went up to him for some prices, and he said, "Oh, you look very smart." And he actually pulled out of a silk handkerchief and put it in my top pocket to sort of go with the suit.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, people wore cravats then as well. I mean, there was a number of single-person firms in those days. They brought out rules later which stopped the single-person firms. And you had that one person would look up, do his own books as well, of course. He'd go down and do his own checking, this sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I suppose in some ways it was much more clubby than what you know of. Well, today it's no longer a club, but even prior to Big Bang, it had changed a lot. And I think you had gentlemen sitting down there probably in their 70s and 80s in those days, and it was a way of life.
Mm-hmm. Did it ever strike you at that stage that jobbers and brokers came from different backgrounds? 'Cause This is the thing that background said.
Complex talk.
Came from different social backgrounds.
I was never aware of it.
Yes.
Put it that way.
Yeah.
If it were so, it's not something I was aware of.
Mm-hmm. Was Durnacker a firm that you ever dealt with when you were with Finn and Crosthwaite?
Oh yes, FNN and Durnacker. Mm-hmm. Oh yes.
Mm-hmm. Where did they figure in the market? We think of them now as being the big jobbing.
Well, they were one of these. One of the jobbing firms, certainly not outstanding. I mean, they were a jobbing firm in the brewery market.
Mm.
I mean, the firm then, I suppose, was probably Ferguson and Clark. Because they were in several of the markets, and I say the senior partner at that stage was the chairman of the Stock Exchange. And in broking terms, probably firms like Foster and Braithwaite were the firms at that stage.
Now, what was the job that Durnacker employed you on? What was the job that you'd been interviewed for?
I was interviewed for various things, dividends, names. They expected me to do a number of different things, and when I went there, I actually worked on their list books, which is a term that's vanished today, really. It was related to passing of tickets, or passing of names, as we called them in those days. You were actually responsible for taking out a list of all the bargains, all the individual stocks. Mm. And at the end of the account, the buying firm would pass a ticket, or a name, call it what you will, to the selling firm, the jobbing firm. And he would in turn pass that to a firm that sold to him, enter it through his ledgers, so the actual difference between the bargains, the difference in the values between the bargains, was collected via the jobber's ledgers. And the seller would deliver to the buyer the stock on that ticket and be paid direct across from buyer to seller, the ultimate buyer to the ultimate seller. That's the way settlement took place then. And the name, it was important to, in terms of jobbing, to actually run a name list accurately, because you get into a mess, obviously. I mean, we were a completely manual firm at that stage, to sort of look at the firm. In some ways, again, if you want to go back on history, I mean, when I went to the city, a stock transfer had to have the seller's name and the buyer's name on it. The seller and the buyer had to sign it. Very often you had numbered numbered shareholdings, and those numbers had to be written onto the individual deeds. If a deed needed altering, in theory, it went back to the person, for instance. You had a sold deed which you were going to deliver to the market, and a mistake was made. In theory, it had to go back to the seller to actually initial. So the settlement procedures were really quite cumbersome. The tickets that actually passed had the buyer's name written on them. You had to write that onto the deed before you delivered it. And the Stock Transfer Act of 1963 changed that, of course, because you no longer had to have a buyer's name on the ticket. And the seller signed it and the buyer didn't. And the other thing at that time, if a person sold, let's say, 1,000 shares, and due to the way in which the tickets were passed, he got 5 different tickets of different, what we call shapes, which added up to that 1,000, then the selling client would have to sign 5 deeds. So he couldn't actually sign anything until you'd actually got the names were passed. You could make out the deeds and send them to the client to be signed. So all delayed settlement, all made it very pedantic and very difficult. And then you deliver those deeds to the buyers, of course, and they would pay you. Stock Transfer Act 1963 changed that quite dramatically, in that the seller had to sign the deed. The buyer's name did not have to be on the ticket. You could subsplit that deed to marry it with these 5 different tickets, for instance, as I was just mentioning, by certifying that the stock exchange, by having to go back to the client. So you could actually send a sole transfer or a transfer to the client well before settlement, so it sped up settlement. So there are the sort of changes that took place.
Did that mean that some firms would fall very far behind in their settlement?
Well, yes, I mean, settlement is one of these animals that there is in a sense, a level of activity which you can cope with comfortably. Below that, you're bored, and above that, you're stretched. And whenever you've got really busy, I mean, you think of the booms of sort of, 68 and 72 and that sort of thing. And I can't go back before that at the moment. I can't think of when the booms were, but it doesn't matter. Yes, you got severely stretched. You'd be working very long hours, and you'd get well behind. The interesting thing about those days was that when the boom passed, people actually sorted out the problems that had come from that period of activity. And firms would follow them up and sort them all out. And we would run a suspense account until we sorted them out. And there might be 6 months before we sorted them out. The last booms we were seeing, people turned their backs on the problems. They were never sorted out. The ethos changed completely, really.
Is this sort of 80, well, post sort of 1982, 83?
Yes, God, I'm stuck for a thought of the time now. But I mean, last times we were busy before Big Bang, I mean, I'd say that it was very difficult to get the problem sorted out, very difficult indeed. But certainly, as I said, going back, though, all the books were kept manually, going back, now moving to sort of Durlacher. It was Durlacher, Deacon, Godstone when I went there. They just had their first merger. All the books were kept totally manually. Theoretically, a name clerk not only entered the bar exam with list books, but he then proved that his list book agreed back to what we called a rough sheet, which was a daily balance of our dealing positions by market. And that in turn was agreed to our journal being the book in which the prime entry was made of the actual bargains, in which we recorded our profit and loss. So it had these three elements which had to be reconciled. And always on the first night after the end of the account, the Monday, we would actually be very late, 9, 10, 11 o'clock at night, trying to reconcile these three sets of books. The rough sheets, in theory, were very important because these were actually kept daily. And they were your actual jobbing positions, in theory. In practice, they were often quite wrong. And of course, the other problem was that by the time you'd actually valued them out, cast them up, the individual sheets, to actually get to arrive at the dealing position, it'd be about midday before the deal, and you were dealing position from the day before. So the elements of control weren't what they are today in terms of dealing risk. But then dealing risk wasn't anywhere near as great as it has become. I mean, in theory, the most important thing in job is controlling the dealing risk, obviously, and therefore you're knowing your book position. But, I mean, moving on, the real change in the scene of jobbing in the context of the diminishing number of firms and increase in size, to my mind, couldn't have taken place without mechanised accounting systems. And it's a little chicken and egg in a way, in the sense that firms were beginning to grow. But at the same time, it is my clear view, as a person heavily involved in the management of settlement and the later years management settlement relative to stock exchanges, in the context of things like Tellers and this sort of thing, that they went hand in hand, in a sense. The growth of the jobbing firms went hand in hand with the ability to control one's records, one's
Can
books.
Can you describe how it developed with Durlacher?
Yes, what actually happened, it was 1957, 58, I think, is a firm, Hollerith, Punch Card Accounting, who became, I think they were British Tabulator, and then became Hollerith, then became ICL, eventually it's inside STC now. They used to, them and IBM actually sold, and Power Summit, they all did punch card accounting systems. And Hollerith developed a punch card accounting system for jobbing firms. The first firm to have it was Ferguson and Clark. And then we had one put into our firm. Myself, one other person who was my deputy manager later on, Victor Blake, and a person called Tom Shervill, who was the assistant manager of the office at that time, became involved in putting this system in, learning how to run it, to manage it. And I say that was at that period. We went away for training in order to use the machines. I mean, you had, I don't know whether you know anything about these punch card accounting systems, you had a card, an 80 column card, into which was punched records. You could actually punch alpha and you could punch numeric. The card in a sense had numeric lines this way and columns that way. The columns denoted fields, and the fields were related to things like quantity of the bargain, price of the bargain, this sort of thing. The firm had dealt with, and every firm was coded. The stocks were coded. We had all our own codes at that stage, both stock codes and broking codes. Well before the stock exchange ever started to sort of think about coding firms. And the way in which you actually ran the systems is you had girls who punched and verified these cards. You had machines to do it. So you put your bargains into these cards, and you had what they called sorting machines, and another machine called a collator, which would merge cars together in a given order. And the sorting machines, of course, were for sorting the cars into given orders. So you'd sort them, you'd merge. So what in effect you did, you had a day's business, which you'd sort into a given order. Mm. The next day you'd sort your business, you'd merge the two together on the collator. Mm. End of a period, you had an actual accounting machine, which you put it through, which was called a tabulator. And the cars would be read by this machine. And then you'd actually print your list books or your jobber's ledgers, and it would actually cast up and total them for you. And you'd run a control to prove that the machine did the job properly, and if it didn't, of course, which they didn't quite often, you would then have to find out where you'd gone wrong in order to balance your actual accounting books. But it totally revolutionised jobbing in that you could control your books. I mean, at Durlaco at that time, it was a fact that we just never balanced. I assume you understand what I mean by saying balanced. Our trial balance, we couldn't balance. It was always wrong. And it's imperative in theory, in terms of double entry bookkeeping, you can actually balance your books. So punch card accounting brought two things really. One, the fact that you could actually balance your books, and you can much more quickly get your dealing positions out. That was one of the first tasks. You got your list books out on time, ready for your actual ticket passing, and they were accurate. In other words, you had a balanced set of records really. Debit set equal the credit, which was rather marvellous. The other thing they did, which was they enabled us to have a concept of what we called position agreements, which was to prove our jobbing position at the close of an account with the action we took in settlement at the close of that settlement period, to prove that the physical, well, it wasn't physical stock in those days, the theoretical stock position equaled the theoretical dealing position. And that was really quite a new concept. It was a stock control system, basically, by another name. A new concept which became very important, and it is in many ways the backbone of the control of the stock side of the business. So in a sense, I mean, as a jobbing firm, you've got two elements which really matter. One is your accounting control, and the other is your stock control. Because you can well appreciate in a jobbing firm, if you think you've got £500 of a particular stock on your book, but you can't actually ascertain where that physical stock is related to that, then you've got to do one of two things: find the stock or write your position off. And we actually used to do both in the early days. But it got control of that situation. Anyway, 57, 58, we put your punch card accounting systems in. They worked very well, and we had them for many years, right through until 1968, I think, before ours went out eventually. We ended up with five tabulators, I think, and two sorters and three collators. And at that stage, we were doing quite a lot of business. I mean, again, I can't really remember the business levels, but we were on to the sort of business levels we've seen in recent times, 5,000 and 6,000 bargains a day, peaking at 10,000, this sort of thing, and keeping control. We became involved in very early stages of computers in 1959. Esmond Durlaco met Anthony Salmon, who was the head of Leo Computers at that time. It's a cocktail party, I believe. As a result of them talking, Esmond Durlaco felt he was interested in the idea, concept of using computers in the firm, particularly from the viewpoint of the controlling our jobbing risk. And by then I had become solely in charge of our punch card accounting system, and I had changed it quite a lot from what it originally was installed, because when it was installed, and again I'm going back a little, you find this going to be rather rambling, isn't it, when you listen to this?
No, it's all very good, very interesting.
When we originally installed it, as a jobbing firm, we jobbed in a number of different markets, brewery market, can't think of another market offhand, but let's say the insurance market, bank market. And each of the sets of dealers would have their own books, obviously, and we had to reconcile back to those books. And the only way we could do it when we put our punch card accounting system in was to actually have a set of stock codes, of which the first figure of the stock code was related to that particular market. So it really meant that, as a firm, in settlement, you ran a number of alphabetical subsections, which meant it was very difficult to actually manage your business. because you had to know, the first thing you had to know if you got a ticket in from the market on ticket day, was it a brewery stock? Was it a textile stock? Was it a wool stock? If you didn't know that, you couldn't give it to the right person. And as we grew as a firm, that changed from a minor problem to a major problem. And one of the things I did when I was put in charge of our punch card accounting systems, I changed the whole system to actually get the whole thing in a straight alphabetical order, but have a relationship back to the dealing book via a dealing section number, if you like, which we allocated to each dealing section. So we then ended up with a much more sophisticated system, which allowed us to suit the office in the context of having an alphabetical system, which is only broken down between equity shares and fixed charges, because again, they're rather different in the whole way in which you operate them. But still reconciled back to the jobbing books and the various switches. So that was our first major change away from the initial system we put in. But I was in charge of that system at that stage, and it was decided to look at computing, and I was asked to become involved with Leo Computers, and I went on various courses with them. And then we designed a system which was related to our bargains being sent to them. After we'd punched them and used them in our own system, they had them. And it might have been the other way around, it doesn't really matter, too many years ago now. This was about